Okay. All right. I kicked off the recording. So I'll start off because I got to be honest, I'm excited. I think this will be good. I honestly, the vibes are right. It passes my personal vibe check.
The vibe definitely was one of the things I was like, this is different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
You notice it immediately.
So I think it's according to either the Alt Shift X video or some other commentary that I've been enjoying. It's so when George R. R. Martin does these tourneys in his stories, it's specifically this one, or the one of which this first novella about Duncan Egg, the Hedge Knight, is about. It is apparently quite heavily based on a movie called Ivanhoe, which I've never seen, but I probably try and see before this, which is the idea that like these tourneys are very magical and colourful and bright and interesting and exciting. And it's kind of the bit of Game of Thrones that I kind of, you know, like it's less bleak, and I think I'm going to really enjoy that. I enjoy the story of the Hedge Knight, and I think this is the one that ends with the trial by seven, right?
I haven't read it. So have you read, did you read the novella? I know there's a graphic novel version or,
played
the game or?
I read the novella a long, 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 long time ago. It's something actually that both me and my mum quite enjoyed together. But she never watched Game of Thrones. Like this is her entry into the world of George R. R. Martin is literally A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. And,
I was watching an interview with George from, I don't know, years ago, where he was saying that was the case for a lot of people, because I guess this was published as a part of an anthology with a bunch of other authors, originally.
Ah, okay.
So people bought the book to read, you know, a story from another author, and then, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms was just in there also. So I forget who else was in that book, but I think I had that tab open somewhere.
So, that's
interesting.
You've made notes, haven't you, Jenny?
Well, I made a couple of notes just from watching, just because that's how my brain works. I mean, a lot of them are just basically on visuals, because it's quite a short trailer. There's not a huge amount going on. And I think just for the sake of clarity, so you were saying you have read them. Max was saying that he hasn't read them. I also have not read them, any of the novellas of Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. I've not actually read it. The closest that I've come is when The House of the Dragon was coming out. Alt Shift X did a bunch of breakdowns of the plot. That was quite a while ago. So I'm kind of going in semi-blind. Obviously, I know what the kind of primary reveal of the first season is. The identity of a key character. I am aware of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether or not we're going spoilers here. I'm aware of that. I literally can't remember any of the other plot details. So I was just kind of going in mostly blank. And just kind of, again, the main thing that I found, as you guys have already pointed out, the vibe is just, I think one of, going back to House of the Dragons, one of your main complaints, Chris, was that it was so dour.
Yes.
And so the whole series was laced with such continuous high tension with very few breaks in that tension. So it always felt like it was kind of coasting on that dread.
Yeah.
While Game of Thrones was slightly better at having kind of like roller coaster rides. So it was up and downs. Obviously, the downs towards the end of the season were not so great. But in terms of like emotional through lines, in terms of, again, tone and vibe, Game of Thrones had slightly more kind of a build up, but with dips and flows. Obviously, the humor towards the end of the series of Game of Thrones got a little bit tiresome.
Yes.
But at least you had those breaks in tension, while House of the Dragon really didn't. And this feels, it feels very refreshing in that it doesn't have, at least from, again, just the trailer, which is a very limited window into the series. And you don't know how much of the tone is dictated by the product, like the actual show, or how much of it's directed by the marketing team. But by nature of the fact that it's, you know, able to do a little bit more independence from the Game of Thrones primary style, I think it will have more humor and more kind of upbeat stuff, at least to begin with. I think particularly when they're dealing with young Egg, I think there's going to be a bit more humor and a bit more goodwill and potentially a bit more optimism than a lot of Game of Thrones is allowed to have.
Yeah, I think so what I've gathered from it is that this is like a bit more character PC. And I think that really kind of suits, because this is going to be, I think it's 6 episodes, half an hour each, which by Game of Thrones standards seems phenomenally short. But I always find that character pieces work best when they're not overstaying their welcome. I think the key example I'd use of that is Firefly. I'm one of those people that thinks that it saved it by getting cancelled after the first season, because it stopped the characters from becoming tiresome. Characters only get, you know, a character will only give you a certain amount of mileage, especially like a show based on it. If you wanted to go longer or bigger, you have to have more. You have to have a bigger world. You have to have arcs and bigger stories and meaning and stuff, similar to like Game of Thrones. And I think one of the reasons why Game of Thrones fell off towards the end was because it focused more on the characters and less about the story. This is from the beginning designed, and again, I could be completely wrong, this is just what I'm picking up from it, is that this is designed to be very much a charming story about a guy pretending to be a knight, and so you got a lowborn guy pretending to be a knight, and you've got a king pretending to be like an urchin. So you've got this kind of almost comedic contrast of these two. So, you know, lowborn pretending to be highborn, highborn pretending to be lowborn, and the sort of the way that they, and I believe the majority of this series is going to take place at the tournament. So it's about how they interact with this world, how Egg interacts with the common folk, and how Dunk the Tall interacts with the highborn. Because I'm going to try, like, I don't really remember enough to give too much away into spoilers. But I think, judging from the trailer itself, the climax of the story is the trial is like where all those the seven, the trial by seven, where you know seven champions go up against seven champions, and a lot of this is I think a lot of this is going to be Dunk the Tall and Egg basically recruiting the seven knights for their side of the trial by seven. So they're like, he's making all these bonds of friendship or camaraderie, that, you know, and that's the stuff we're going to fall in love with. Apparently the Baratheon guy, if you go to the bit on the trailer, it's like 2:08, where they do have the knights on Dunk the Tall's side, like gearing up. You can see very clearly that there's the Baratheon guy who comes across in the trailers. I think he's called the Laughing Storm, and he's supposed to be like this Robert Baratheon type, this big, this loud, this very charismatic party animal. And I believe that he's supposed to be focused. He's supposed to be featured more in this series than in the books. I can't really remember much from him in the books. But like, he's one of those people that like, he takes a shine to Dunk and sort of sees his potential and sort of aligns with him. But like in a kind of very Baratheon kind of way, it's like, I like a fight. I like this guy. He's my guy. Let's fight things together. Arr. And
very Arnold Schwarzenegger. Is it Predator, where they do the classic muscle man versus muscle man?
Yeah, yeah.
Bro-ship.
Bro-ship. Bromance. That's the one. Yeah, like a. and you see, I think the guy that you see, the Targaryen guy, he's like the bad guy. He's the sort of older, sort of the Joffrey Baratheon, the Aegon, sorry, the Joffrey Baratheon, the Aegon Targaryen kind of Aegon Targaryen from House of the Dragon, kind of like dickhead, maybe a bit Daemon.
I'm trying to remember, is this a story that features Bloodraven back in the day?
I don't think it does.
Part of the origin stories of Black. Okay.
Hang on a minute. Was Bloodraven. Before this.
Okay.
I think.
Hang on a minute.
Isn't Bloodraven this generation, though? I feel like Bloodraven.
No, he might be. During this generation. Yeah, no, he might be. I don't know, actually. Bloodraven.
Bloodraven. Yeah, no, he's Egg's brother.
That's it, yeah.
No, he's not.
Is he a bastard? I feel like he's an advisor to the current princelings.
Oh, God. This
but isn't the primary. Regardless. I can't remember exactly, but I do remember. I feel like he's involved in this particular time period. I can't remember if he's involved in this particular branch of the novella.
Well, he. What I found interesting about this, it never really occurred to me since it was actually listed in the trailer. Something like, does it say even in the trailer, like some like 100? Is it like 80 years before Game of Thrones and 60 years after the end of the Dance of Dragons, or something to that effect? 60 years before Game of Thrones, 80 years after. Basically,
It's 80 years after where we are right now in House of the Dragon.
Right. Yeah.
I know that.
So it joins together these two periods, because there might be people in this show. They'll have to bring them in, I think, as a cameo.
I'm trying to remember, is Egg Daenerys' grandfather or father?
No, so Egg is the Mad King's grandfather.
Mad King's grandfather. There we go. Okay.
So Bloodraven was before. Okay, I was wrong about Bloodraven being Egg's brother. Bloodraven was born. He's way closer to the House of the Dragon generations.
Okay.
Is he alive? He's alive at this point. Is he in a tree?
He was born in 175, and Egg was born in 200. So he's 25 years earlier.
He's 25 years old. Oh, well, he'd be like...
Well, he'd be in his 30s. He'd be in his 30s during this show.
Yeah, so I think he's an important player in this particular set of stories. But I can't remember if he's directly involved in this, in the tourney. I genuinely can't remember. Like, I'm trying to remember from watching the Ultra Seth video years ago. And also, I'm going to try and resist the temptation to rewatch those videos.
The thing is about
series is out.
Yeah, I think the thing is, like, I don't think this is a show where the spoilers necessarily ruin it, because it's one of those things where it's about the journey, not the destination. It's the first novella of many. And I think, like, even the trailer itself, like, it shows everything right up until what looks like the trial by seven. So if you know, in terms of, I don't think they're being too precious about the story. Although one thing that does look quite neat about it, which again is a known thing, is there's the love interest in it. I've forgotten her name. Something the tall lady. She's this like really tall lady, and it's like you don't see it very often in shows where like there's a tall lady who's the love interest. That's kind of like, yeah, it just seems nice. Also, she's absolutely beautiful. Like, she's not
in terms of my notes, just one of the things I noted is the extreme lack of female representation in the series, considering we've just had House of the Dragon, which has got a very heavily female-focused plot. This is very much taking it back to default knights in armor. Obviously, it is a series of events set at a joust, at a melee, at a, you know... so it is going to be predominantly, and obviously two of the main characters are, the two main characters are male leads. But I was just like, oh, we have literally one female character in the trailer who has no lines. Okay.
But she is a very important character. Although, Although, well, I hope they don't set her up as a damsel in distress. That's all I'm saying. Like, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that they're going to try and subvert that a little bit, because that kind of is what Game of Thrones does. But the story is about defending her honor effectively. And like, I know that's a bit like going down the a very old fashioned route, right?
Well, again, it's Game of Thrones. So much of the story framing is these are archetypes and you're expecting the heroes to win and the baddies to lose. And you're expecting the damsel to be the damsel, but so I have no doubt that there's innate subversion within the original story, because it's a classic tale of a knight, and they are going to just slightly subvert it. So I'm not too worried. And one of the things again in my notes that I thought about when seeing the lack of female representation is also the lack of female representation also results in the lack of sex position, at least in the trailer for the first time. And it just feels like in the same way that they seemingly learned a lot of lessons from Game of Thrones for the House of Dragon, I feel like they've also learned a lot of lessons for this series, where it seems to be a lot less focused on, hey, look at the tits, and a bit more like, hey, look at the plot. I don't necessarily want to get rid of women for the sake of that, but it does, it feels like they're, again, lessons being learnt to try and gently move away from some of the worst aspects of Game of Thrones. Highlight some of the best aspects of George R. R. Martin's ability to tell stories. And, like, the ability to tell stories is not based on dicks and tits, necessarily. They can supplement the story. Yeah. But like that was definitely one of the things in Game of Thrones that was particularly off-putting to new viewers as well. And a lot of viewers at this point, particularly, you know, we're talking, how long ago did the first season of Game of Thrones come out? 15 years ago?
Oh, about that, yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about a whole new generation of people who are potentially visiting the world of Seven Kingdoms, Song of Ice and Fire, for the first time. And you, like, when Game of Thrones came out, it was bros don't like fantasy shows, but maybe we can throw some tits on screen and then bros will get into it. And now we're dealing with a generation that is actually like, no, we appreciate fantasy for what it is. Let's have fantasy that is within the world, but also, you know, telling a subversive story. But people can enjoy people with a capital P, not with, you know, not just bros. I think having something that's a bit more accessible and not having to be, like, again, baited is really appreciated. I think it's a lesson that they, maybe, like, we say it's lessons learned, but I think it's something that, you know, maybe the original Game of Thrones couldn't have done. Maybe they needed to have this exposition to get audiences in. And now they have a loyal fan base who are big fans of Game of Thrones wanting something that has a slightly better chance of being successful and not going downhill, because the books are basically written for this set of novellas. And then the new fan base don't need, as much as they perhaps needed to for Game of Thrones, things that now we look back on and go, that was a bit shady and a bit gross.
It's amazing how the first season of Game of Thrones in particular has aged really quite badly in that aspect. Yeah. Like, I couldn't recommend it to someone who... I feel like the world was very different when that came out.
If we're saying 15 years, like, the world has changed a lot since then, not just in the perception of fantasy, but in the perception of what respect, like, nice, like, good TV is, in respect of to, like, what good fantasy is. Like, you know, 15 years ago, we were still in the, you know, even post Game of Thrones, it's still a level of, well, if we spray paint chainmail silver, it'll be good, and they can have a slow motion sequence with a sword and, you know, green screen backgrounds. That's what fantasy shows were. And Game of Thrones did a lot to kind of bring it back to sort of grounded realism, but it had its faults. It's been a long time, so I feel like there's a lot that they could do.
Change
of tone and the change in attitude is appreciated.
Yeah, this is, I mean, as far as Game of Thrones can be, like, wholesome. in a way that I quite like. And I think a lot of it is like how the world, like a lot, you know, it could be a reflection of like how the world is, right? Like a lot of shows, a lot of big media things that are happening now are kind of bouncy and campy and colorful. Whereas 15 years ago, things were, yeah. And I think now that like there's a lot of like real grim shit happening in the world right now, I think a lot of people want their escapism to be colorful and adventurous and exciting. And like the idea of just a knight and a squire just having an adventure just seems like not necessarily like in a childish way, but in a way that isn't just gritty and nasty all the time with hope.
Yeah.
You know, like a bit of hope. I would like to see some hope, some yeah. promise, you know,
it is a big balance because the way that you were initially describing that in kind of out of context, if you hadn't seen the trailer, and you didn't know what we were talking about and you described it as colorful and jolly, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, oh, Marvelization, it's like a Marvel movie, quippy and blah. And it's definitely not that. But in comparison to the, like, mid-2010s, early 2010s,
yeah,
where it was just cynical and cruel. There was a lot of cruel TV. And this by nature, is a cruel world. Like, the Game of Thrones world is, by nature, quite a cynical world.
Yeah.
But this is kind of, by nature of honing in on two characters that are, for all intents and purposes, basically good. And their way of interacting with the world. It does feel more hopeful, and it does feel more joyful is not quite the right word, but yeah, hopeful and upbeat, and you can still have the conversations of morality and dangerous world and all those sort of things, but you can just do it with a slightly, like, with a glass half full attitude.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And, you know, it is more colourful. I really appreciate, like, just going into the pure visuals, the sheer amount of fun armour.
Yes.
On display in this. Excellent. The horse armour. Excellent. Really enjoyed all of that.
The big Baratheon horns.
But at the same time, the big Baratheon horns, and the fact that clearly at some point during that scene between Dunk and the Baratheon guy, they've clearly gotten drunk together and they changed crowns. Or they, like, at one point Dunk's wearing the horns or the antlers.
Is he? Hang on a minute.
And then it's, if you rewatch it, like there's one of the shots, Dunk is wearing the antlers and then the Baratheon guy is not. And so clearly that's like drunken broship, like, let me try on your hat or let me try on your spectacles. Oh my God, how do you see? Type thing. Like, it just, there's little things like that, which are just, it's crunchy visual.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it just feels very like drunk bros being like, hey, I like your hat, let me try it on type thing.
That's kind of, yeah.
And it's color without it being colorful, if that makes sense. Like, it's not a dull world, but it's not like a in Technicolor. And the actual environment is so shrouded in mist and grey and rain and misery. It feels very, like, it feels very natural and worn as a world, but then the characters themselves can pop a bit more on screen, if that makes sense. And I really enjoyed the kind of the misery of the world. The misery of the world seems very, like, it's damp and it's moist and it's clammy, and I bet there's, like, it feels very, very
British.
Very British. but the characters themselves can then kind of shine out a bit more. And I from a production standpoint, I think that's really, really smart, both in terms of highlighting the characters and addressing kind of where the world is, but also from a production and a budgeting standpoint, it means that they can use maybe four sets. There's like the bridge, there's the scene with this tree, there's the indoor set, and there's like the actual tawny set. So there's like four sets to cover the entire movie, unlike House of the Dragon, where they had multiple castles, multiple CGI sets, multiple like dragon riding in the sky scenes. Yeah. This is all at ground level, where they just kind of, presumably they shot some stuff on an actual old bridge, some stuff out in the wilds, and they built a tawny set. So in terms of budget, it's incredibly intelligent to do it in a mizzly, rainy, misty setting, where you get all of the earthiness, but you don't have to spend extortion amount of money, so then you can focus on hiring the right actors, and as far as I can tell, mostly unnamed actors, like unknown actors.
Yeah, there's no like Matt Smith or anything.
There's no Matt Smith, there's no Sean Beans, there's no Lena Headey's, there's no, like, I don't recognise any of the cast, and because of that you can really get into the characters, and we're talking about being character piece. And I think that's just really clever budgeting. You don't need a big face. If you're going to cut the budget by rounding it and not having giant magical beasts, or, you know, the dragons and the werewolves, the wolves.
Direwolves.
So much budget.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Mimi says hello.
Oh.
Hey, Mimi.
That you can really kind of get into what the story should be about, which is the people. And I thought it was really clever, really sensible, thematic, and also budget conscious set design and prop design. I really appreciate it.
Honestly,
pay for multi-millions for a dragon that's animated when you can just make a dragon puppet?
Honestly, like, the dragons don't do much for me, if I'm completely honest. I like the direwolves more. I wish that's where they'd have gone with the budget. But also, it does kind of feel like the more they spend on Game of Thrones, like, it doesn't return in quality. And I think this is designed to be like the humbleness of this series, I think, is very much by design. Apparently it's a big deal that they're not going with the Game of Thrones grand intro. They're going to go with a basic title card. The budget is like, well, they don't have dragons, they don't have direwolves, they have very little to have to worry about in this regard. It's not even going to be taking place over that long a time. 6 episodes of half an hour each, which I quite like, actually. The first Mandalorian series was about like that, wasn't it? And I think that worked really well. Had a bit of an old school kind of vibe to it. Monster of the Week kind of thing. And I think the fact that they've brought all of this down to a more sensible level, I think actually bodes really quite well, because it seems like they've got to think about what they're going to do with what they have, and I'm hoping that will just result in something that's a bit more just, you know, pleasant to watch, really. I think
it's a classic thing with when you have limitations on some of the showy things, you can actually focus on what matters.
Yeah.
Like when you have, like, it's a classic thing when directors are told they have unlimited budgets and no oversight, that you're going to get passion projects that aren't well thought out, and you don't have collaboration because you have limitations. And when you have limitations is when you get some of the best creativity and some of the more complex choices.
Yeah.
And I think it's, as you said, stripped back down. Also, it thematically matches with the story, like having it a humble story. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, also, like, politically, this is kind of an interesting time. So it's after the Dance of the Dragons, where all the dragons are dead, but the Targaryens are still sort of, like, I guess at this period, people must be questioning a lot, like, why are the Targaryens in power? Like, they used to be in power because they had dragons, but, like, you know, it's almost like the Targaryens in decline, but, like, an earlier part of their decline. And it'll be interesting to see, do the smaller lords start, are we going to start seeing some of the political machinations of the smaller lords, maybe, saddling in to maybe take advantage of the decline of the Targaryens? I know that this is not going to be a particularly highborn-centric story, but I mean, you've still got to find your top knights for your seven, and I'm assuming that the seven, the other guy's seven, not to give too much away in spoilers, the Targaryen guy, his is it six? So he's probably got to have like six guys, trial by seven, right? It's you and six others, seven, right? It's not you and seven others, I think, right? So you got to, like, I'm imagining that a lot of the story is going to be like little micro character stories about how, you know, each of the people on the sides of this big joust. Because I kind of liked it in Game of Thrones where, and also House the Dragon, that like the Kingsguard were like kind of important, like they each had a story and a relevance and a reason why they're there, and an approach to the job as well, like a bit of a personal philosophy. And I really like that about the Kingsguard, Game of Thrones, and House of the Dragon. And I think we might see like a little bit of that kind of thing here. Like, why align yourself so wholeheartedly with someone else? And also, to like add an extra depth to that, why Duncan the Tall, who's basically a nobody?
Yeah, I think it's interesting talking on how refreshing this looks as something in the Game of Thrones universe. It is the first story that is focusing on predominantly small folk. And it's one of the things that was kind of lacking from the main series, was that, you know, as much as we relate to the main players, they were almost entirely highborn. I can't think of any of the main cast that was not highborn. That was something that we occasionally would bring up when we were talking about Game of Thrones. Was,
well, High Sparrow.
It wasn't actually talking. Well, question mark on his identity. And also, by that point, I don't think he was ever a POV character.
No.
And by the time we met him, he'd risen. Hot Pie, yes. Yeah, so, but would you count Hot Pie as a primary player?
In my headcanon, yes, because Hot Pie is, in my mind, a very important Game of Thrones character, because, so like, one of the themes of Game of Thrones is like surviving in a cruel world, right? So a lot of it is like based in patriarchy, because the women are subjected to a lot of the cruelty of the world. A lot of the men too. And a lot of small folk are, you know, it's like, so every story in Game of Thrones has this element of how do you survive? And I like that Hot Pie's little micro story in this is he survives by being a really good cook. No one wants to kill a really good cook. You might switch sides a few times. But like, yeah, being a really good cook is an excellent survival mechanism. It got him through Game of Thrones unscathed, basically, nearly. So, you know.
I mean, I'd say his character represented an underrepresented subset of characters in Game of Thrones, but I wouldn't Chefs. Call him a primary character. Well, small folk. But, like, I would be interested to see a story from the ground up, and also things that is constantly played with in both Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon is how perception works, so lines of communication, so things like war information getting misconstrued from one castle to another, or missives or messages being misinterpreted or sent from one place to another, and having the perspective come from the ground up, where they might not be privy, the two primary characters are not privy to the machinations of kings, they're not privy to court spies or, you know, all of that sort of thing. So all they have to go on is what they see before them. You know, the classic when the rich wage war is the poor that die. Actually having them kind of float through the story as external parts of the primary drama, if you're talking about the drama of kings, is really refreshing. It's really nice to see. And yeah, I'm excited about it.
Absolutely. And I don't entirely know why what caused it to get pushed back to the end of January, because that would have been a real nice end of year treat. But I guess, you know, needs must, right? Like, I'm not gonna, you know, I try not to like make it matter when things get pushed back, because it's like, well, it needs to get pushed, right? It's fit, you know, it takes time to finish, right? But like,
I mean, between the two choices, if something is unfinished, I'd always rather it be pushed back so it's ready than be pushed forward so it's not. And for me, because I think I will enjoy this series, and it's been whispered about it happening for a while, but I've not been actively following it. So the fact that the trailers popped up, I wasn't like, oh gosh, I can't wait, I've been waiting for so long. It was more of a, oh, that's nice. It's a pleasant surprise. And so we're well, not like a pleasant fruition to a rumor almost. So I'm happy to wait, and I will happily live in anticipation of it without being like, I am hopeful to enjoy it. Unlike Game of Thrones,
Game of Thrones,
House of the Dragon, I remember dreading coming out. I remember thinking, God, it's just Matt Smith in a wig. Ugh. and being very happily surprised. And this is very much like I'm very much on like a medium level of expectation. Happy to be impressed or unimpressed, either way. But I'm generally excited. I'm not going to follow every single update. I'm not going to be waiting for cast lists. I'm not going to be like having casual conversation with you guys is absolutely lovely. And I will watch it when it comes out, hang out with you guys and talk about it. But it's not something that I've been like, oh my God, I can't wait for the Hedge Knight series to come out. Ah,
I'm very much in that category. Like, I like the story. I like the aspects that are covered in it are the bits of Game of Thrones that I kind of like the most. The events, the pivot moments that happen. Like, I hope one day, and maybe I'm being a bit optimistic, that we'll see the tourney of the big one where Thingy runs off with Thingy. Stark. What's the name? The one that sets Lyanna Stark, and is it Aegon Targaryen or something like that?
Rhaegar.
Yeah, that one.
I'll be interested to see if we get to that point.
It probably won't. I can't imagine it happen because it happens at such an awkward time. Like, I don't think that I think it's generally seen as unlikely that Robert's Rebellion or the events in that era are likely, you know, they're not a priority to put on television. But that would be one that I think could be enjoyed. But
that's one that I'd really enjoy to see visualized through a slightly different media.
Mm.
Like, I feel like that could make a really good like animated series or animated short film if they choose it like a good art form for it.
Yeah,
I think that could be like a really like showing the truth, quote unquote, because one of the things that I really enjoyed about House of the Dragon is because the way that the story is written, it's very, you know, the truth is not objective, all of that jazz. I did enjoy what was put to screen is supposedly the objective truth, and I am using quotation marks there. But like, that was really fun to see, and I feel like the tourney at, was it tourney at Harrenhal? Is that where that one was?
That was, yes.
Yes, so I feel like the tourney at Harrenhal being a HBO approved adaptation of events, which you who the I can't remember what Lyanna, the knight that Lyanna dressed up as.
Oh, the laughing, is it the Laughing Tree?
Is it of the Laughing Tree, the Knight of the Laughing Tree?
I think that was it, yeah.
Showing her and revealing that thing in some form would be really fun, but I don't see it being necessary or... I don't see how it would work as either a short series or a long series or part of an overall running series, because that doesn't necessarily... I like, is it like a animated HBO movie to show Robert's Rebellion from the tourney up until the death, or like the birth of Dany? I think that would be really cool. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah,
I don't think it would necessarily fit the live action format that HBO has put forth so far. It'll be fun to see if they can do it at some point. If they can do it well.
From an HBO point of view, it wouldn't have the value. You know, you couldn't do much more with it. But like a one-off animated film or something like that could be kind of cool. Because it feels like an interesting, I'm quite fond of those. Was it Histories and Lore of the Seven Kingdoms or whatever it's called? They're a bit like low production, but
yeah, if they want to do like a super high production version of that, but for Robin's Rebellion, I'd watch that. I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah, definitely. But anyway, I'm gonna just look at the cast list. So we've got I don't recognize anyone. Oh, but interestingly enough, the guy, Lionel the Laughing Storm Baratheon, is cast at the top of the cast list.
Like, I didn't recognize him, but I got the vibe of a very accomplished actor. He's one of those actors that immediately I was on screen, I was like, he's gonna have a presence.
So
that I didn't actively recognize him.
Okay, he was in The Crown.
Okay, I gotcha.
No, I've never watched The Crown. I know.
I want to try to find out who he played.
Okay, so here's something very
Parker.
Something very interesting. I'm looking at the cast list here, and the cast fall into one of two categories. They're either in all six episodes or one episode. So, and I don't know if this is maybe it's not up to date or something, you know, so like maybe IMDb is just putting in the best guess. But if this means anything, right? So Lionel the Laughingstorm Baratheon, he's in six episodes, every episode. Duncan the Tall, six episodes. Prince Maekar Targaryen, who I think... Prince Maekar Targaryen, six episodes. Prince Aerion Brightflame Targaryen, six episodes. Egg, six episodes. Prince Baelor Breakspear Targaryen, six episodes. Prince Daeron the Drunken Targaryen, six episodes. Sir Raemon the Reluctant Fossaway, six episodes. Sir Stefan Rossaway. Who is the Rossaways? So they're all the ones that are in six episodes. So the Foss, I do not know that family. And then you've got Sir Arlen of Pennytree.
I don't know the name.
So Arlen of Pennytree is the guy who allegedly... So he's the guy that Dunk the Tall squires for. So he's... And allegedly makes Dunk a knight. However... I believe this series is going to go in the... It's left ambiguous as to whether or not Pennytree knighted Dunk the Tall on his deathbed. It's supposed to... Like, the reader is supposed to think, oh, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Does it matter? No, it probably... Like, that's kind of how the story goes. I think, from what I've heard from the Alt-Shift-X and the other commentators, apparently they're going to lean down on the side of he wasn't knighted... And he's just going to say he was. He's going to pretend. And the
Knight's Tale.
Yeah, Knight's Tale. And like the moral of the story is this guy who's pretending to be a knight is more of a knight than the actual knights. That's kind of like the vibe of the story, which is kind of nice. But in the ones... So yeah, Arlen Pennytree is the... Like, and I think, judging from the trailer and what I've seen so far, is that it seems like off the gate, he's dead. Like you don't... It sort of kicks off... He's burying his master. Then you've got...
I did notice in that scene that it seems to me that he's being buried beneath an elder tree, which...
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know whether or not elder trees are canonical to the world of Game of Thrones off the top of my head. I'd have to reread the books in great detail, but elder trees in real-life history, are famous for being guardianships of the dead and can live hundreds of years and are often found in graveyards.
Oh, that's really cool.
So, they're really cool elder trees. Elder trees are pretty nifty. And they're basically immortal as trees, unless they get cut down. And I noticed it. And I put it in my notes, because I was like, if that's an elder tree, that's pretty cool. Mm. Nice reference.
Oh, that's cool. We have Sir Roland Craycall. I don't know who that is. Can't remember him from the books. One episode. Steely Pete, I think, is the guy that makes Dunk the Tall's armor. Plumber is the he's the clerk guy that you see in the trailer, and I think that basically he's the guy that Dunk has to explain his knightness to. Like, he's got to, oh, you're a knight. You're not just some guy that's walked here off the street, right? You're, genuinely a knight. Who's your, who's the guy that made you a knight? Where's your history? Where's your papers?
Yeah, I need your credentials.
Yeah.
Your passport.
We've got Sir Humphrey Hardying. I don't remember that one. Oh, we've got Sir Manfred Dondarrion. So Dondarrions are back. Lord Leo Longthorn Tyrell. Okay, we get a Tyrell. We get Sir Humphrey Beesbury, who is a descendant from, of course,
the Beesbury.
The Beesburys, yeah. Do they have bees on their shield?
I think it might be a honeycomb.
Something like that, yeah.
That's entirely going off some form of osmosis memory that could be entirely fabricated. That could be a fever dream for all I remember.
I've got a couple of books about real world heraldic shields, and there it is a thing. They have beehives on shields. Like that's kind of a thing, an actual thing.
And it kind of makes sense to have a, because it's hexagonal, so it can be easily duplicated. It's mathematically simple, but also has a lot of connotation. So I can see why bees and or hexagons/hives could be used. It seems like from a heraldic standpoint, like drawing a dragon and doing a dragon well, repeated over the course of lots of different versions, either shields or crests or flags or in metalwork, is really difficult. Making that consistent is difficult. I can see carving a hexagon into an armor or painting it relatively easy to maintain the copyright continuation. So good job branding for the Beesbury's.
Absolutely. We've got Lord Medgatully. So
okay, we've got Tully.
Okay, and so all of these are men. We come down to our first woman, Tansel, who is the queen of love and beauty is often referred to as the, you know, the, she was the queen of love and beauty, was the one from Lyanna Stark, right? Was it Lyanna Stark?
So it would, if it's one of the tourneys of that nature, then the I think I can't remember whether or not the person who bequeaths the title to the whoever is fairest in the audience as to be the current royal prince or the current competitive winner within the tourney, because obviously it was Rhaegar Targaryen who presented it to not his wife and to his future lover. So it's unclear whether or not I genuinely don't know from my memory of the main Game of Thrones books whether or not that is something that could be. Whether or not that was something that Rhaegar invented for himself to present, or whether or not it was the leader in the combat sphere can present it, or whether or not it's the royal prince or the royal attending to the tourney has the power to, to state who gets that particular honor.
I don't remember any queen of actual queen of love and beauty stuff. That's not to say it's not in there. I just don't remember it. If it is, I think that it's like
the title that's used.
Yeah, or like maybe symbolic. You know, maybe she's like the symbolic queen of love and beauty.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the things where, like, if it was a modern thing, I'd be like, let me Wikipedia the etymology of the Queen of Love and Beauty. But I'm sure if I were to Wikipedia that without context, it would be very blank. Yeah. Also, I don't know whether or not that would be a thing. Again, having not read this particular book, I don't know whether or not the Queen of Love and Beauty is something from Rhaegar's generation. Like, he was like a classic warrior poet, a lutist, and a lover. So I can totally see that being an invention of his own prestige, but I do suspect that presenting a favor to a beautiful woman in the audience, or a beautiful lady in the audience, not a woman, because woman includes the peasantry, would be a tradition in some form or another as part of the tourney.
But yeah, you I mean, you're totally right. Like, there's only one woman on the cast, so there's more women in the producer roles than in the show.
Well, that's, in a way, that's promising, because, again, one of the things I found refreshing about House of the Dragon was the fact that it was a very female-centered story, and, again, not just the poor reception of the tail end of Game of Thrones, but also the fact that, you know, a decade has passed between Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, and another 5 years have passed between House of the Dragon and now. Like, the female characters, when they do appear, will be treated more kindly and with more respect than the actors in Game of Thrones and the characters within Game of Thrones were treated. So I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful that the one female character will be a more complete character than a lot of female characters that were presented in Game of Thrones and treated better.
Actually, there are in the production crew and the directors. Like, there's a decent showing of women, actually, just going on the names alone. You know, some names aren't always clear, but yeah, you know. So it doesn't, yeah, I think it's just the nature of the story that sort of lends itself a bit patriarchally.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah, well, and it's also the nature of the setting. If you think about where, it's not just the nature of the main characters and their journey where they are at the moment.
Mm.
It's also physically where they are at the moment. It would be, you know, the modern day equivalent of it, the entire series being set at a football match. Like the majority of participants who are going to be active participants will be men,
or a fire station,
where it stands currently. Yeah,
I mean there are female firefighters. Shout out, but
yeah, there totally are. But generally speaking, the audience and those invested in the activity and those able to participate in the primary activity of the plot in this location will all be men. So that's, I don't mind it as long as it serves the subject.
Yeah. I think, yeah, and it would be kind of hard to put women in without crowbarring them in.
Thinking about gender.
Yeah, and that might not be
If you were to add a woman to the story that doesn't fit with the current, what was written, they would be potentially stealing character traits from other women that are featured later on in the series.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, Lyanna Stark, who was the crowned the Queen of Love and Beauty, and then was also theoretically the Knight of the Laughing Tree, Brienne, who was also a woman in armor, or one of the noble ladies who's heavily featured in the latest in the main Game of Thrones stories. Like, we have plenty of those female characters, and trying to come up with a character that isn't, sorry, Beam says hi again, isn't part of the main, like, that wouldn't take away from those archetypes. It's a similar thing to you having said that you've just watched Lord of the Rings recently. You said you just watched The Fellowship, you haven't watched Two Towers?
Just The Fellowship. But that, I don't know, that, I mean, that does feel, I understand.
My specific reference for this is actually from The Two Towers, but I don't know how familiar you are, having not watched those movies before, or I don't know if you've read the books. There is very famously a woman in armor character. And there is another character who is female, who is, again, a lot of the female characters have a bit more presentation in the films than they do in the books, but the character still stands. And there is a deleted sequence, which is not included in the extended edition, which I'm very glad they didn't include. They decided to completely remove it from the story, where they have this character who is a woman in armor. She's a really important character that you haven't met yet. And she has her sequences and she has her movements, all in keeping with the books. There was a sequence that they added to the movies where a different character, female character, turns up and does sword fighting and things, which is very unfitting for that character. It's very unfitting for the story that's presented both in the book and in the movies. And would have taken away from the other character's arc, journey, and reveal as the important figure that she ends up being. And so I don't necessarily want... I think it's a disservice to, quote-unquote, strong female characters or female representation to add women characters to a story where they're not necessarily fitting into the logic of the story just for the sake of having female representation. I think that's a greater disservice than not having them in at all. I'd rather have one or two good representations of female characters who have full, complete stories and backgrounds and whose decisions make sense. I'd rather have that than 20 characters that were written as men. Like the classic Hollywood, oh, we wrote it as a man first and then we just decided to cast a woman. That's fine in theory, and a lot of the times you can have female characters where that works, because there's a lot of things that aren't bad. But in a world of Game of Thrones, where so much of the world has got a patriarchal undertone, changing women to just have them is not effective gender representation. And again, I'd rather have a singular female character who has her importance within the story and is well played and well acted and well written and is treated with respect for whatever the story designs her to do. 1,000 times more than 20 female characters in armor to then take away from future archetypes.
Yeah.
And future characters. But yeah, that's the rant over.
No, absolutely. Like,
sorry,
it's
not a Johnny rant.
Yeah, it's a super patriarchal world, and yeah, like you've got to, you know, make your pieces fit, right?
Yeah. Like, there's no point trying to shove a piece into the jigsaw that doesn't fit when you have a perfectly good jigsaw without.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have another jigsaw, you can have different pieces. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so question: do you reckon we will see visually on screen, I knocked the table there, the cat's paw dagger?
Oh, I hope not.
You don't want to see it? Just as a background prop.
I think it was ham-fisted enough into House of the Dragon. I think particularly the amount of attention that was drawn to it in the House of the Dragon as well. Like, I think, you know, to be a MacGuffin that transcends, like, if it's the one MacGuffin to transcend all three Game of Thrones series and have that much attention drawn to it, I'd rather not. Like, something else. Bring me something else that's iconic. Like, I don't know, the forging of a crown or an important sword or something else that maybe was featured in Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, either or. There's plenty of iconic imagery that could be brought forth. I feel like that one is just, it's a bit overplayed. Maybe in a couple of seasons' time. Maybe in like season 3 of Duncan Egg, they can have it. But I think given how much it was focused on in House of the Dragon,
mm-hmm.
Like it was a bit too much even then. And that was a story based entirely around, like they put way too much importance on it for a MacGuffin, in my opinion.
Okay.
Oops.
In Game of Thrones, Sam has...
It's visual shorthand, but I think it's still too much.
Sam found it in a book, didn't he? And
found it in a book, and it was used to assassinate, or attempt to assassinate Bran, and then it was Peter Baelish used it to threaten Ned. And then it went round and round and round. And I think, did Arya finally use it to kill the Night King?
Yes. That's its importance. Yes.
Like, it's already... It's such an overused MacGuffin.
I mean, it's...
My opinion.
I don't know, like...
I want to know where it is. I want to know where it is at this point in history. We don't have to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, I don't want to make a big deal out of it. No, not at all.
But it ends up with Tyrion.
They're gonna.
It's like
with Tyrion.
Start
of Game of Thrones.
But maybe it's like, okay, I know this is getting in the realms of being a bit silly now, but maybe it's like the One Ring, right? Where it kind of like finds its way towards Arya and the Night King, right? Like it's trying to find its way to someone that can kill the Night King. That's its kind of purpose. And in that journey, it might gravitate towards the people who can use it the best, or the people who are the best candidates for the Night King killer.
That's what I don't like about the theory, is that it then, like, so much of George R. R. Martin's kind of storytelling primary pitch is the idea of people versus fate, and, you know, how, you know, it's not objects that do the work in the end, it's people who do the work. And the concept of, like, for me, it lessens, like, obviously, the tail end of Game of Thrones will always annoy me. But like the concept that the final MacGuffin, if you're going to have Arya doing it, the concept of the final MacGuffin, or the final thing that did the deed and defeated the Night King, was a dagger that has sentient or otherwise driven itself towards her, lessens her achievement and lessens her effort.
I mean, I will go on the record and say
the idea for this world.
It should have been Theon that killed the Night King. Justice for Theon.
Oh yeah.
Hashtag justice.
We all agree this.
Because he is the Prince of Winterfell. There's an episode called The Prince of Winterfell. Like, he's the prince that was promised.
Yeah. Yeah, that proves it.
Proves it. Checkmate, atheists.
Oh my gosh, Theon. There must be a way that Theon fits into the prince that was promised. The old.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've watched a lot of video essays about this.
About Theon specifically, I think Theon's one of the ones that I haven't heard about.
Have you not?
That was promised Theon. I think I've heard you talk about it a couple of times, but of the options, he's not been high up the list. The ones that I've heard. Sure, I'll take it. Take
he's,
it.
He's okay. He's right. Go,
if
like
it
just
makes your brain bank happy. Put some interest into that.
Yeah,
I'm more than happy for you to have brain bank.
He's a prince. He's a prince. He was born amongst salt and smoke. Now, there's a few ways you can interpret that, but Sia Salty. He in the Greyjoy Rebellion. You know, he was like 10 when that happened. Okay, but like you know. The smoke might have been the sacking of Winterfell. What else was there that he? What was the else? Other parts of the prophecy? Part Targaryen.
Under a bleeding star.
Oh yeah, well the bleeding star happened around the sacking of the Targaryen, the sacking of Winterfell. Did it? Yeah,
I feel like it was like a couple of years later, but not. I'm sure if you were to like that, that's the thing with the prince that was promised. Like anyone, pretty much anyone can fit into it if you argue it well enough.
Yeah, yeah.
I fully believe that justice for Theon should have happened, and in the end, it just shouldn't have been. I appreciate Arya, I really do, and I've just pronounced her name in two different ways because it is pronounced two different ways depending on interpretation. But yeah, I don't believe it should have been her. I feel like going back to the point at hand, the dagger, I can see it being a shorthand drawing of the three stories together. Like a visual shorthand. I just don't like the concept of it being like I feel like George R.R. did a lot of work to get rid of the concept of the almighty magical sword. If it's had so much highlighting in House of the Dragon and then it's highlighted again here, it just makes it seem like the almighty magical sword that will save the world. And I don't particularly agree with this universe having level of power in an object.
Yeah, but the thing is,
antithetical to the series as a whole.
Now, everything you said was correct, but it's it's a little bit like knowing where it's going. You get to see it early on. Does that make sense? Like you get to see.
It can be a puzzle piece.
Yeah, like a puzzle, but like
future arc.
Yeah, like I mean, it's very. I don't know if retconning is the right term, but it's like you can the fact that it's such an old knife and just seeing it pop up in all of these interesting events, like it doesn't do anything. Like, and at the end of the day, it is just a knife with a prophecy written on it. But it is also just like yes. It could be completely rational and like it has nothing to do with the knife itself is of no magical importance. It just happens to be. But the happenstance of it is the mystery, right? Like the mystery of it and the magic of it is that it could not be magic, right? Isn't that that's kind of the thing. Am I just talking nothing? Is this just air coming out of my mouth?
If it brings your brain joy, I totally get that, and I also totally get that. I think my issue with it is if they hadn't drawn so much attention to it in House of the Dragon and made it so important in House of the Dragon, I would 100% be up for appearing in this to draw that together.
I don't. How important did they make it in House of the Dragon?
I want one of the Targaryens in the background to be using it as like a steak knife.
Oh, that would be good. I would concede to that.
There'd be no attention called to it.
I don't know. Because at the beginning of Game of Thrones, midway through season one of Game of Thrones, it's revealed that it ended up with Tyrion. It ended up in Lannister hands before it was won by Peter Baelish, or the other way around. So I wouldn't mind, like, seeing, like, maybe, again, not this season, because I think House of the Dragon's still too close, but maybe in a season or two in Duncan Egg, having, like, a Targaryen put the dagger up as, like, collateral for a bad bet, and then losing it to some complete nobody, or losing it to, like, that could be fun. As long as it's, I think you're right, Max, that having it being kind of a mundane kind of midpoint for the dagger, I think would kind of make up for it.
Yeah.
Like, somehow it's been forgotten, you know, since Rhaenyra's time by the, you know, the current Targaryens. It'd be...
Or, like, someone trying to sell it to, or trying to put it on, what's the word? When you sell something briefly with the intent to sell it back and you get money.
Oh my God. Short selling.
Yeah, so someone trying to pawn it, and then the, like, person who's buying off them will be like, nah, piece of tat. Not worth a penny.
So on in...
It's still Valyrian steel at the end of the day.
Yeah, so. It's dragon bone, so it's quite fancy, which might be... that might go against it in that way, that, like... Maybe people don't know what dragon bone is. I don't know. Is it even dragon bone? Am I just making that up, or...?
I think it's...
I don't know.
I think it's I think... I don't know what the handle's made out of, but I think the blade's obviously...
Valyrian steel. Yeah, yeah, and the handle is the handle dragon bone, or am I just, like, bullshitting?
Like, I like the idea of maybe someone, like, pawning it, and then the person pawning it misidentifies it as tat.
Yeah.
And, like, puts in a drunk jewel with a bunch of other stuff because they don't recognize it. And
well, it's going to be. But it's Valyrian steel, right? Like, no one's going to sniff, turn their nose up at Valyrian steel.
Maybe. I will take back my original, I don't want to see it. I would like to see it in a really mundane context. I think that'd be really funny.
In House of the Dragon, when Aemon Targaryen wears it on his belt, and the camera, like, zooms in on it loads, right? Like, it's in every shot, from a director, you know, like, in terms of direction, yes, it's like made a big visual deal. But, like, taking that away, isn't the only time we hear about the cat's paw dagger the first episode? And even then, it's not necessarily the dagger, it's what's written on it, right? Am I right? Like, it's really more of a...
They have the whole... No, they do make a big deal of it, because then in the carriage with what she called the Queen Mother and Aegmund, she, like, gives it to him and is like, your dad really wanted you to be king. And he's like, yeah, that's bullshit. She's like, no, he really did want you to be his true heir, even after... speaking for his daughter for all these years, here's the dagger. And then he wields that dagger at his coronation. Isn't it also, doesn't he then give it to his brother? And that's the dagger that he uses to threaten to cut out what she called son's eye.
Oh,
it's been a while since I watched House of the Dragon. I'm so far behind on names.
Is it Luke?
But yeah, isn't it that same dagger that he uses to threaten to cut out his eye? And isn't that also the dagger that's getting...
Yeah.
I feel like that it's featured quite a lot. That's it. It's about once every other episode.
It's
fine. I don't mind it being an important part of House of the Dragon. I think having it as a throwaway gag.
It's not an important item, series, though.
I think it would be funny.
It's just a thing that is there, right? Like, it's not important, right?
I mean, they put quite a lot of importance on it.
So in terms of the story itself, it doesn't have much to do in the plot, right? It's mostly just that it's there, right? It just makes I'm taking your word for it. I'm assuming that it gets tossed around a bit. Like, I know it's the one that, Alison threatens to stab someone's eye out with.
Yeah. No, it's the one that she cuts. Rain. Oh my God! All the character names from House of the Dragon have gone out of my brain.
They're all the same.
Yeah, it's the one that. Yeah, they're all the same. It's the one that the evil queen uses to attempt to kill the
other evil queen.
The green queen. The green queen attempts to kill the black queen by trying to stab her off the whole incident with their children, and it's the one that gets the cut across her arm. And then it's also the one that her son then uses to threaten the other one's son to cut out his eye when they're adults. It's used it's featured as a key prop in almost every other episode.
Fine. You're right. I got nothing.
I don't know if it's featured as much in season two, but definitely in season one, it's every other episode.
Well, there's less interpersonal turmoil in season two. It's more grand, right?
Yeah.
Well.
But yeah, I don't know. I'd like it to maybe feature again, but in like a mundane thing, I think would be really funny.
Yeah.
I'll be back in a sec. I'm just going to sort out Mimi one more.
God bless.
Carry on without me.
Have we got much more to say? Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. There's going to be like a whole bunch of new houses, I guess, that we haven't seen yet. Because like in the tourneys, you get a lot of the knights that are, or not even the knights, but like a lot of people that are just sort of trying to make their way up from
trying to make a name for themselves. Spread their influence.
The Laughing Tree guy. I like that you see a scene with him in his armor next to his horse. Like that they've kind of got like the bronze armor that I think you saw Robert in a few times. I think you saw a couple of Baratheons in it. It's just like
I'm excited to see the Baratheons.
Yeah, I think the Baratheons are going to make it seems like there's a lot of Baratheon kind of like stuff going to be in here, but I mean they're quite a big house. They're Stormlands, right? That's like one of the big major houses, mm-hmm. right? So they're going to be. I think they're going to be like the main. I suppose that they are the main antagonist to the Targaryens in a lot of ways, right? So the
right. Where is Robert's claim to the throne?
Robert's claim
he's related to the throne. So actually, Egg is his. Great grandfather as well. He's Robert Baratheon is the great grandson of Egg.
The great grandson of Egg. That's okay.
So spoilers, I guess, for probably after the novellas. But Egg's daughter marries a Baratheon.
Okay.
So
yeah, that sounds about right. But then yeah, so. But was his claim to the throne really a bloodline claim, or was it?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
That was a big part of the justification of it, like that why he wants to exterminate all the other Targaryens, so there would be no. So his blood claim would be the best.
I remember now, because that's why he was so keen on killing Daenerys and Viserys. Because
yes,
they were like the only ones alive that could have had a claim that challenged that.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot more sense now. Because in my head, I just figured it was like he won because he fought, like he conquered. But
well, yeah, I guess, yeah. I mean that too.
I mean that in practice, but yeah,
support his claim.
One reinforces the other, right? That's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I also one thing I'm kind of curious about. So you're a young king or a young prince and you're going incognito. Like a bald 9-year-old I don't know, how incognito is that?
Does he keep like shaving his head like every day? Like how are they're going to notice after a couple of days he has golden blonde hair.
Yeah.
Right? Or he's not bald, right?
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Oh, what are we talking about?
Bald kid. Like,
bald kid.
Like, isn't everyone going to know? Because it's like, he's just adopted a cancer survivor. And it's like, obviously that doesn't happen in Westeros, right?
I'm wondering whether or not there's any precedent as Varys shaves his head because potentially secret Targaryen, blah blah blah, rumor.
I wish that was a thing.
Who knows? But like, is it potentially something that they do to young eunuchs, and that's kind of like the uniform of young eunuchs? I don't think we meet too many Westerosi eunuchs, so maybe it's the implication is that it's. Sorry, Mimi's probably going to be very talkative for the next 10 minutes because she's just had dinner. I'm sorry.
Our cat is just the same.
invoking the pagan deities of all cats. I do apologize if you do hear her.
I have been fed.
I have been fed. Also, occasionally, I have done poop. regardless, I don't know whether or not it's maybe a precedent for young eunuchs to shave their head or something like that, because obviously Varys is known to shave his head, and that's partially so he can do costumes and partially, but I think it is also something symbolic of, like, eunuch or indentured servitude or something like that in the... like in the culture of Westeros, so it's potentially something like that. Or maybe it's, if we're going just pure medieval history, maybe it's the implication that because he's a poor priest, had to shave his hair because of lice. So it might be something like that. It might be literally lice or illness, a classic thing with medieval scholars into the Victorian era is having no hair is a sign of ill health, which is still technically true for a lot of reasons. So it could just be that the implication is either he shaved his head because of insects or other body living critters, or that he has had illness and that's why he's bald. I don't know whether or not, like, I don't think it would be so shocking of a sight to see.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I just
go along with it.
I wonder if they'll address it. It's like, oh, yeah, no, I got lice, yeah, you know, lice.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if they have a throwaway line at some point going, oh, are you bald like an egg? Or, you know, I got a case of the scabies or whatever.
Yeah. But anyway, long short.
I don't know if you can hear Mimi right now.
Oh, she's adorable. I love it.
Honestly, my first time doing it, just an audio recording since I got her, and I'm like, oh wow, this can be a thing.
I have energy, I am full.
You gave me Felix.
So at least we've got a date for it, January the 18th. Like, that's they've done that, they've said it.
It was supposed to come out like now, right? But they pushed it
end of this year at some point, yeah. But I don't know.
Kid, speaking of the kid, that kid, by the time next season comes out, he's going to be like an adult already. That's all these shows these days with the kid characters, that like totally screws them when years pass between seasons.
Yeah, I think I did make note that he seems like, I don't know how old the actual actor is. I haven't looked him up, but I'm assuming he only just turned 10 or 11, so they got hopefully a bit of time with him before he ages out of the role. It's definitely between season 1 and season 2 of House of the Dragon, we were like, oh wow, those kids have become adults.
Don't know how they'll, yeah, maybe they'll just knock him out really quickly. I don't know, like, I think the actor's 9, and it's like, I don't know, even the ages of year, like, of 9 to 12, like, they zoom up pretty quickly. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And also...
Maybe they'll recast him every season.
They might, I don't know, we'll see. I did hear that George R. R. Martin has, like, there was always a talk that there would be more stories to be written. But the latest I've heard is that George R.R. Martin says that there could be 10 of these like novella stories in the pipeline. Now we've all heard promises from George, so you know, put whatever stock into it as you want. But he also did say that Night of the Seven Kingdoms was like the most fun thing he's ever written. Like it wouldn't surprise me if he's got a shitload of those just in his back pocket, ready for a second draft or whatever.
I mean, judging from the cultural osmosis of how he's discussed Game of Thrones or The Song of Ice and Fire versus his novellas, I think the level of burnout he's had from Game of Thrones, obviously the fact that he's basically said, like, don't hold your breath, it's not really going to happen on finishing it anytime soon. I think having energy to write short, whole, simple stories where, like, you know, you can tell what you want to tell, it's very appealing to him, so I can see him doing more. And it just, like, going from, again, the tone of this trailer, I've not read the books, as I said, if the tone of the trailer is implicatory of the tone of the books, then it just seems like a more enjoyable time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice.
That's nice. Cool. All right, have we gotten everything we can out of this trailer. Well, we've got
a few more notes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Jenny speech at the end of the episode where I'm like, here's 10 things I wrote down. So I really found it cool that I don't know whether or not in the melee it's meant to be more like non-deadly weapons, or whether or not it's a sign of the character of Dunk that he's got a wooden scabbard. He's got a wooden handle with like an undressed handle to his sword. And then his sword is, he doesn't have a proper scabbard. It's a leather scabbard, but it's tied on with rope. And I don't know whether or not that's a significant part of his character description in the books. The fact that he doesn't have a leather belt to hold on his sword, it's held on with knotted rope. And there's also throughout the entire trailer,
Scenes
where the rope is quite heavily featured in the background. Like there's rope on one of the bridge shots. There's rope in the back of the stables. His belt obviously is tied on his sword with rope. And then also his horse, instead of having a full proper leather bridle, is also held, like its reins are made out of rope. So I'm interested whether or not that is going to be just a visual shorthand for the fact that he is obviously an unfunded hedge knight. He doesn't have a lineage and a heritage, and he is a pauper for all intents and purposes, or whether or not that's going to be more metaphorical in terms of he's tied down to his limitations from his station. But it was just a really interesting visual cue for the way that he's dressed in that sequence, and someone is assisting him with putting on his knightly armor, presumably for the melee or for the tourney. But his belt, he can't afford a leather belt, which you think would be like even a base level belt would be a necessity for anyone who can even wield a sword. But he's got a wooden undressed handle and a rope belt, which I thought was really, again, visual shorthand for Game of Thrones. The costume design, the set design, everything they do for the entire franchise so far has been top notch. And it's things like that which tell you so much about the character. And I really enjoyed that, and I did note it. I found it interesting that, I think I've already mentioned the dragon puppet. But in terms of the storyline and where it's set, it's kind of almost halfway between Dance of Dragons and Game of Thrones. So there are still living Targaryen dragons. There's very few of them, and they're not combat able, but they are still there. So I'll be interested to see whether or not at any point during this series they kind of comment, you were saying that you were commenting on like the fall of the Targaryens or the slipping in power of the Targaryens. But if we think about it in terms of like generational, I wonder if we'll have a generational conversation at some point where people are nostalgic for the dragons or kind of live in a post, like the equivalent of the 1970s generation who didn't live through the war or through the Second World War, having that kind of strangely idealized or strangely nostalgic or the PTS of post-war from the older generation, whether or not at some point we're going to have that discussion, which again could foreshadow back into House of the Dragon. But if we have like an older gentleman or an older character who maybe was a child during the tail end of the Dance of the Dragons, kind of suffering from the trauma of that or burns or whatever, having that discussion, I think it's a really interesting time to set this. It's kind of right plonk in the middle, but there are still living dragons because Baylor the Black, was it Baylor the Black Dread or Balon? Which one was the Black Dread?
Yeah, but I think it's Baylor the Black Dread, yeah.
Is that because he died during the Mad King's era, didn't he?
Oh, was it?
No, the dragons are dead by now, I believe. Or
I feel like in Game of Thrones there was like still like twisted hatchlings or something. They never got bigger than a horse or something like that. I feel like there were still dragons at some point pretty close to the Game of Thrones era. I feel like it was closer than we thought. I know most of the dragons are gone, but I think it'd be interesting to see whether or not that it's at the point in the canonical timeline that there is a kind of residual memory of Remember When.
So
I wonder if that will come up as a story or as a conversation at some point.
Okay, according to Google, the last dragon died during the reign of King Aegon III in the year 153 AC. So about 50 years before this.
So there would definitely be dragon.
There are people that will remember dragons.
PTSD in this generation.
For sure.
I'll be interested to see how it'll be. Really, the first time we've seen, so the closest we've come to the reaction of the common folks or the small folks versus dragons was when Maelys was her corpse was carried through King's Landing. And we talked about how that was designed to be a good political ploy, where they're like, haha, we've defeated the enemy dragon, look how powerful we are. But all it did was kind of lessen the idea that dragons are flesh and blood, and that maybe the kings aren't just kings because the dragon can be killed. I find that interesting to see a full like century later, or the thought process and how it has. I'm just interested to see the reaction to dragons, and also again because there won't actually be anything dragon other than puppetry to be like nostalgic of dragons or telling the story of dragons or the dance of dragons. That they can spend the budget on other things. It's a really nifty concept, and I put it in my note. There was other like tiny little set dressing things that I constantly noticed. So obviously there's the conversation about the shooting star, and then that can lead into the Prince of the Promise and other shooting star things within the world of Game of Thrones. So that was a fun little kind of question about fate and destiny versus people who believe in faith and destiny. I think it was a really interesting conversation between those two characters to feature in the trailer, where the like questioning, you know, if you see a shooting star then it's lucky or whatever, and the guy, and then Dunk was like, well, is it lucky for everyone who sees it, because theoretically everyone sees it, like, you know, the concept of fate being like, if you wish to believe in fate, you believe it applies to you and you alone, being hypocritical at best, was just a fun thing. But there was also there was a lot of sun imagery. Like there was a lot of, I don't know which house has got a sun as part of their heraldry, but there was banners with a sun for heraldry.
On the
pavilion overlooking the melee, presumably with the lordlings, there's sunflowers looped around one of the posts. So I can't remember which family or which heraldry that represents. It was quite a prolific image that I kept noticing,
and
I kept noticing throughout the trailer. I kept also noticing and sunflowers and that sort of thing. So just little iconography I kept noticing. So I don't know how prolific that'll be in the actual series. It was just enough that from a visual standpoint, from what was shown in the trailer, which was predominantly rainy, muggy, cloudy and grey, that there was a lot of implication of sunshine, which could speak to potential hopefulness, or it could speak to the idea that, you know, you're not seeing reality, you're just seeing through fog. I don't know. There was you can metaphorize anything, but it was just something that I noticed repeatedly throughout the trailer, so it must be enough that it's iconic. It's nice to be back in the Game of Thrones world where I'm seeing everything and being like, what does this mean? Does this mean something? I'd spent a good 30 seconds looking up the horse statues.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Or not they were also the same horse statues as the ones from the Enter to Vaes Dothrak. And I also looked up the tree on the hill to see whether or not it was the same hill that Ned decapitated the deserter. Like, there's just the visual language of the world of Song of Ice and Fire is so tasty and detailed that I'm trying to draw connections when there may not even be any at this point, but it's nice to get that sort of crunchy lore feeling again. And I said that I wasn't necessarily going to be holding my breath with excitement to watch a series, but like, I do miss that little if you see this in the background, it could mean a thing that means a thing type theology behind this series. It brings me joy.
Yeah. I'm Googling around for that one with the chevron on. And it's telling me it's House Dane. It's not House Dane. House Dane is a purple background. So I'm just trying to work it out. Ashford?
Yeah,
I did. White Stone, chevron on orange. Ashford. Let's see.
Is that who's hosting the melee? Because in the stable scene, there was like banners.
Yes, House Ashford. There we go. Found it on a Wiki of Ice and Fire. Right.
Oh yeah, I don't know. They must be relatively important within the story. Again, having not read the story myself recent and only watched the UltraX videos a while ago, I don't know how prolific they are within the actual meat of the story. But clearly, within the limited information given by the trailer, a good percentage of the shots featured
okay.
particular iconography.
So they're from the Reach. So in Game of Thrones season 5, I think is when they make their premiere, Sam presents some paperwork to Lord Commander Jon Snow consisting of requests to various noble houses to send new recruits to the Night's Watch. A few houses can spare men during a War of the Five Kings, so the Watch is left scraping the bottom of the barrel. The requests are mostly to minor lords that Jon says hasn't even heard of, including Lord Ashford. So, In A Song of Ice and Fire novels, House Ashford is never mentioned. It is unknown which side they took at the Battle of Ashford and at Robin's Rebellion in general. House Ashford appears in The Hedge Knight, the first of the Duncan Egg stories. So it seems like they're a house that really kind of, for the most part, revolve around this story.
Okay.
Andro Ashford, his eldest son. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. Yeah, it seems like it's a very minor house. I don't know why their banners are so big, to be honest.
Well, I'm interested to see what role they play in the story, and it might be that this is a story tells of maybe they were a well-known house and then something happened in this story that made them lesser known, or maybe this was them trying to step up the ladder and failing because it wasn't chaotic enough. I just noticed it enough in the trailer that it drew my eyes, and particularly the sunflowers. I don't know why the sunflowers in particular drew my attention. I think it just seems like an unusual, given that the casting of the weather makes it feel either very early spring or late autumnal in terms of weather and tone and temperature. Mm-hmm. It seemed odd that this particular location was able to acquire sunflowers. It seemed like a very high level, the equivalent of nobility getting hold of strawberries out of season. Like it seems like a prestige show of power and wealth to be able to get sunflowers to decorate your stands. And I don't know, again, this is just how my brain works. I do enjoy that sort of, whether intentional or not, crunchy little detail if it is intentional, because it just seems telling of what this type of society views as a priority. That they would want to decorate their pavilion with sunflowers in autumn.
Yeah, I mean the background storytelling in even the later series of Game of Thrones was good. The costumes made sense. Like, you know, you look at shots of King's Landing and you see that because it's like a town with a lot of merchants, a lot of trade, you see a lot of people from in a lot of different outfits, but then you go to the north and everyone's wearing the same grim shit. And then you go to where Corlys Velaryon is from, those islands. People are a bit like, they dress quite, you know, in brighter colors because again they're on trade routes, they have access to you know, more exotic products and things like that. It just, I don't
I,
know
I
like,
talked to you, I think, was it me that sent you Banner's breakdown?
That's the one.
The historical accuracy of the costumes, which is like, the thing is, once you've watched that, it's so hard to watch other fantasy shows. Like, once you've seen how simply and effectively Game of Thrones did visual storytelling through costumes, and then that obviously falls into the set and the stones that could be quarried, or the wood that could be sourced, or the food that would be available, the dyes that would be available. Like, it is, once you realize how good Game of Thrones is at doing that, other fantasy shows rarely hold up to the same bar. And it's really so nice to be back in that world where that sort of detailing exists, and I just find it very satisfying. So I wish other fantasy shows could abide by the same rules, obviously make up their own versions of it. I think it's Game of Thrones where they made the conscious decision that buttons were never made. buttons don't exist in the Game of Thrones world. This is a branch timeline where no one invented buttons or buttonholes. And that it's just, it's such a simple bit of storytelling. But it's just a deviation in the universe. So in this world where dragons exist and all this stuff, no one thought to make a hole in fabric and feed something through it. Buttons don't exist. Like, you have to brooch or tie or, like, there's lots of different, or belt. Buttons are not a thing. And that is, it's me as someone who likes to sew but hates doing buttonholes. I totally get it. It makes no sense to me that you would cut a hole in expensive fabric in order to feed a fastening through it when you could attach a string or attach a tie or use a brooch. But just like one simple rule that makes it different from our known universe. Western culture.
I'm kind of with you on this one.
It's neat.
Because it's like with buttons, right? Like, you see this much more with cheap shirts than you do with expensive shirts, but like it still can happen to expensive shirts. Like the fraying of the buttonhole, like how many, like so often, and like fixing a fraying buttonhole is a pain in the ass. Like, to be honest, like.
Same, 100%.
Yeah. And also, like, all of my cottons that aren't white or black are shit. Like, because I don't, like, why? I'm not going to buy an expensive, like, green fucking thread. Like, why? Who want, like, no, I'll live with black.
From a very simple, like, that is the most, like, of all of the costume features they could have chosen. That one is the one that kind of, it makes most sense from a logical standpoint. It means that the labor of fastenings can be put to other things like embroidery, which clearly the universe of Game of Thrones has a deep love for embroidery, and very talented embroiderers as part of the world of the dressmaking and everything. And it just, it's such a simple thing that immediately moves it away from our world as we know it. And makes it feel...
You might have just radicalized me against buttons, to be honest.
Down with the system, down with buttons.
Is this what the Amish were on about? They were just like... Because the Amish, they don't wear buttons, do they?
We won't be one of your sheeple who wears buttons.
Yeah, the Amish do not wear buttons. They have buckles.
They have the
lacing.
What are those things that are like buttons, but they go through a loop and they're a big toggle thing? Is that what they?
I mean, I call them a toggle, but
you see them on children's coats a lot because they're like easy to fasten up.
Yeah,
when you're
children's waterproofs.
Yeah, yeah, they're toggles. They don't count as buttons, right?
I mean, I always counted them in the field of buttons. I would have to ask a fashion historian for the exact
don't the Amish have toggles? I'm going to Google.
It probably depends on the sex. They vary a lot by region. Have you ever seen an Amish person before? You probably
no
have them.
I don't think.
Oh my god.
But you're in Pennsylvania, so you've got actual...
Yeah, I'm in Pennsylvania. I see Amish people, not all the time, but, you know, pretty regularly. Like, you know, we'll go to the Amish market, like, pretty often because they have great food there. And it'll be Amish people that run everything. They all dress very traditional, very, you know, conservative.
So
every once in a while, I remember that Amish people exist, and it's just one of those things where I'm like, that's a subset of humanity that still exists. That's kind of nutty.
I can imagine they make some pretty hardy furniture. Do they, they don't drive cars, right? Do they get the bus?
No. Maybe. I know a lot of them, if they need to, you know, go a long distance somewhere where they can't bring a horse and buggy, they just, you know, hire. They call everyone who is not Amish English. So to me, to them, I would be English because I speak, because my first language is English, right? Their first language is a dialect of German called Pennsylvania Dutch. We're the English world. So they hire English like drivers to drive them around in cars sometimes, because it's okay with their God if you pay someone else to do it, as long as you're not the one sinning, it's fine.
Is it the Amish who, when they do sewing projects or embroidery projects, they have to deliberately do a missed stitch at some point or lose a stitch? Because if they aim for perfection, then it's an affront against God's perfection.
Oh, I've heard this more with
before. I don't know if that's true or just like a.
I've heard this rumor in like Moroccan and Egyptian cultures, but I don't think it's. I don't believe it myself. I think it's
entirely honest. As someone who does so, I have never been able to make a garment in my entire life that doesn't have at least 40 mistakes in it.
Yeah.
So if you're deliberately putting mistakes in, then you're more talented than I will ever be in my entire existence.
I think that's one of those things that people just like say to not hand wave away mistakes, but like, you know, it's like basically it's their version of saying no one bats 100, right? Like it's just like, God would be upset if I made it perfect, you know. Like it's just like it's just a thing that people say, right? Like
that's what they say about Game of Thrones. Like it couldn't have the whole series couldn't have been as good as season 3 because otherwise it would have been too good and people would have been upset.
Oh yeah, God would have been mad. They'd be like, you can't make Game of Thrones that good.
You can't make a perfect series.
So do Amish people have like a very car-free day-to-day life? They just have, is it smaller? Because when I look at America on GeoGuessr, to me, it seems like an entire country built for the car, right? Like if you don't have a car in America.
Well, if they want to get around somewhere, they take the horse and buggy. You know, every Amish family will have, you know, a horse, like a couple horses in a buggy generally.
But that's not a car, like a horse.
No, but it still goes on the street and it, you know, can get you, you know, to somewhere in town fast enough. You know, you can't go much further.
A bike is faster, but I'm guessing
they'll just hire someone.
How do they get money? Do they just sell furniture and food?
They sell furniture. They sell food. They do construction. They do, you know, like quilts and textiles, and they're really good at making money. They, you know, breed dogs. They find lots of things. There's a lot of really wealthy Amish people, but they're just, it's all tied up in Amish stuff.
Hang on a minute. Do Amish people spend money with each other, or is that against the rules?
Well, yeah, they'll spend money with each other, I think, but it's mostly, you know, most of their money comes from selling to the quote-unquote English.
Yeah, because I always figured that Amish had a bit of they considered money to be somewhat sinful, like...
Yeah, you know, well, they have especially opted out of Social Security. Most of them do not have Social Security numbers because they consider that a form of gambling. And gambling is really like a sin for them. They usury, but they still use banks. So,
oh, they use banks. Okay.
Some, I mean, yeah.
I bet that women don't use banks.
Probably not. No, not as frequently as men.
Do you see many Amish women? Sorry, I don't know why I'm asking all these questions.
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot. I mean, lots of Amish women work the stores and stuff. I like how this conversation completely turned into the question.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to relate it back to the hedge knight.
Like, from your point of view, do you think they've got anything right? Do you think they've shunned anything in the modern world that that everyone else should have shunned. That, you know, they've looked at something and think, oh, not that internet. I'm assuming they don't use the internet.
They're not supposed to, but I know that there are definitely young people that have secret cell phones and stuff.
Yeah, I'm imagining that's more of a rebellion thing. They're not supposed to, right?
They're not supposed to. It goes against their teachings. I think we could all do with a little less internet sometimes, but I think generally the Amish lifestyle is wackadoo.
Extremes of any mentality is too much. Like extreme commitment to internet life and life, we talk about pretty often when people die because they've been streaming for 40 hours, or you know, obsessive. Like every extreme is not great. So extreme anti-technology is not great. Extreme reliance on technology is not great, and you could say that for anything at all. A lot of the things that the Amish people do is very commendable. There's a reason why people go on nature retreats and turn off their phones and go wire-free for a couple of days. And that a lot of that can be easily idealized, particularly in a modern age where technology is so deeply like part of culture and unavoidable. I have no problem with them. I've never met one.
I'm guessing they're
good people.
Okay, I mean,
they believe crazy shit, but you know,
I mean, a lot of America, a lot of people do. Like, I don't want to pin that one squarely on Americans. But it's a funny old world. But you know, I'm reluctant to ask any more questions because I don't want to like veer into like. Prejudice or stereotypes or anything. My next questions was going to be about inbreeding.
Well, that brings it back around to Game of Thrones quite nicely.
Yeah, there you go.
Do they marry within their community? You know, a lot is that kind
of?
Yeah,
they don't really marry outsiders, but I think they try to avoid cousin marriage generally.
Okay, so they try their best, they
try to mix between different Amish communities because there's millions of Amish people between like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, the whole like Midwest. There's a ton of Amish people, so they move around, they get around, intermingle.
And is it all Amish people? They're bilingual then, I guess. They speak English and Pennsylvanian Dutch.
Yes, they're pretty much all bilingual. Pennsylvania Dutch is their first language they speak at home, and then they all learn English at school.
Is that so?
They run their own schools.
Well, I'd expect that. It'd be weird to go to a school as an Amish person. Like you can't wear a school uniform. Oh yeah, you don't have school uniforms in the States, do you?
Well, private schools. Oh, and in some cities, some public schools do too. But I never did going to school. I never had a uniform outside of gym class.
Did you ever wish you had a school uniform, or is it fine? Just
no.
Did it ever have a?
It was just normal. It was just normal for me not to have one. I thought it was weird. Yeah. My friends that went to Catholic school that they wore uniforms.
Yeah, I kind of think it's a bit weird now. And also, like, weirdly, like, it's an expense that I feel is not necessary. It's just, like, it's quite, a lot of it is a racket.
I see the arguments for it, too, about how... There are definitely arguments for it, but it was always the weird
for me, anti-fast fashion and practicality standpoint... I really appreciate, like, there's something that I've only grown to appreciate as an adult within the last couple of years, but for uniform for schools, I appreciate as a parent, if I was a parent, the idea of being able to say, okay, cool, we're washing your uniform, then you're done for the whole week. That's what you're wearing. And to have that convenience of the same clothes that through the same cycle, you can wear the same, like, it's not. Like the pressure to buy lots of different outfits for children who are wearing lots of different outfits every single day and have to look respectable and, you know, put together. like having a uniform takes the pressure off the parent. I, as a kid, obviously the argument was always like, oh, you know, you all look the same, so there's less chance of bullying or all of that sort of thing. But as an adult,
see, I reckon it goes the other way.
You can only, I think it does both things. I think it does.
Because like the school, like when I went to school, for a large portion of it, the uniform was white shirt, black trousers, and you wear your school tie for the most part, which yes, to me was fine. It made sense. It made life easy and straightforward. But like nowadays, like public/state schools, like they have blazers and shit. Like it is fast fashion. They have embroidered polo shirts and
that's fast fashion. So, you know, I've never been a particularly high perspiration person, even when I was doing physical activity, but you know, I could wear the same shirt for 3 days and then another shirt for the next 3 days. So that's two shirts that I'm wearing throughout the whole week. And again, I'm not a high perspiration person. I learned how to use deodorant pretty young. So maybe it wouldn't be the same for, say, a teenage boy who's experiencing that sort of thing for the first sort of time and might not be as hygiene conscious. But like, I also had cast-offs from my older sister that I wore for a good chunk of time. I don't think I could say the same for clothing that my sister maybe would have bought 5 years ago. I wouldn't necessarily have been able to wear what she bought 5 years ago. But with uniform, same.
Well, yeah, no, it would be great, except that schools change their uniform every 5 years. Like, it seems as case. Like,
I mean, it's been 15 years since I was in school uniform. I can't speak to it. Oh, more than 20 years. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I mean, talking of expense, though, Kingsguard white cloaks. We've already talked about this before in great depth. Maintaining white cloaks in a fantasy medieval time in a city that is renowned for smelling like shit. Like, that's a challenge. I don't envy the water people of King's Landing. So I can see how uniform, if it's maintaining white shirts as a reason when I'm still in a uniform profession. I do have a set of clothing that I wear every single day, which for me really helps me as an adult. I really like being able to put on, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to make conscious decisions. I just put on the same clothes pretty much every single day. Because that is the work clothes that I'm expected to wear. It's a certain set of clothing. I do have slightly more variety than my colleagues because I'm a manager, but I have curated about 8 skirts that I wear and about 4 shirts that I wear. And I've owned these shirts for over a decade. These shirts are shirts that I wore in my previous job, and then I brought them back out of storage for when I was able to choose my own uniform. I said, I'm not wearing white, I'll wear black. Because I will get stained.
White is awful. We should retire white.
White is the worst.
Let's just all agree. No one wears white anymore. Because like, here's the thing.
No one wears white. It's just terrible.
You just gotta like I've got one white item of clothing. I've got a white shirt for funerals, basically. Like, it's just like you got the color mix in, and it's just all awful.
You can't eat, you can't drink, you can't get muddy, you can't move. I will spill tea on everything I own at least once anyway. But like, for me, it really helps to have a set uniform, and it helps save an expense and a thought process in the mornings. Like, I don't trust morning Jenny, who has to get up at 6 a.m. to go to work. She don't want to decide what she's wearing every single day. He wants to just grab stuff out of a wardrobe and just go.
I mean, a dress code is fine, you know, but like where it loses me is when you have to buy the branded clothes.
I went to a place then.
Yeah.
I went to a comprehensive school, and even with like the tie.
You get a tie. You get a branded tie.
It was tie, a sweater. Polo shirt for summer, which they only brought polo shirts in for the summer. When I was in year, I think I was just about starting GCSEs when they brought in polo shirts. And there was a PE kit, which was generic black shorts and a t-shirt. All of my ones were cast off.
This sounds like a racket. Also, like the guy that running the polo store has some.
Oh, it totally is a racket, because a lot of these polo shirts that they sell in schools, or the embroidered sweatshirts and things, like, they're not cheap. It would be cheaper to buy an unbranded, just general sweater. And a lot of schools, they crack down on like bootleggers as well.
It's, I mean, I was allowed to wear a plain black cardigan, and I was allowed to wear whatever shirt or trousers I wished. Obviously, I did go to quite a, not an underfunded, but not exactly a very well-funded comprehensive school. And the other thing that all of the schools that I went to, both primary and secondary school, because primary school had a uniform, and my second primary school had ties as well, but all of those ones had cast-off cycles. So if you purchased your clothes in the end of the year, your clothes were still fine, you could donate them back. And so other people could get the clothes significantly discounted. So you could buy the branded stuff secondhand through the school. And obviously I never had that because by the time they came to me, I was the smallest member of my family. I had an older sister and my twin sister is slightly
bigger build. I'm a little dubious of those.
So I always had third hand.
Yeah, but like also like the thing is, you know, I feel a little dubious about these schemes because it feels like it's a way for teachers to hand wave away concerns about cost, because it's like, you know what kids are like. Now, you and your sisters, I'm sure, treated your clothes with a great deal of respect, but you're like, how many kids of our age just like they were playing in the mud and shit and, you know, wore them out and stuff. And it's like, you still got a situation of like have and have nots, assuming that everything's your size, which also, side note, why are we putting kids in blazers? Like, that's fast fashion. Like, because either the kid, you have to like buy a blazer that's like three sizes too big and it looks ridiculous and hope the kid grows into it, or like you just have to buy it like a new blazer all the time. Sorry, I'm weirdly ranting.
Blazers. This is a powerful tangent.
Blazers have no place in a kid's wardrobe. It's weird when you see kids in blazers.
I mean, I can't speak to it, having gone to a base level comp.
Our base level comp has blazers. That's the thing. That's the thing I'm outraged about, is that, like, now, like, it is such a racket because they're getting, like, poor kids to try and find blazers, scrabbling around in secondhand places or having to cough up, like, 45 quid for a blazer for a kid. If you're, like, that's like a weekly food budget. I don't know, like, food's gone up a lot in price now. It's like, man, you know, there was a time when it made a degree of sense to just have a real solid like dress code and maybe a school tie. But like, we are not in those days no more. We've got embroidered polo shirts that you have to get from a particular retailer. I mean, talk about a captive audience. And like,
bring it back around to Game of Thrones.
Yeah, though, okay.
Did you have a cool heraldry for your school? Because I'll be entirely honest. My school,
I wish
crest
my school had heraldry.
was my local town crest. Even though we had a school named after our town, there was the boys' school and the girls' school that were like town girls, town boys. I'm not going to say the name of my local town because it's still pretty close to where I live now. But we had the boys and girls' school, which was like the fancy school, and then my school.
It's the school of England,
named after the town. the school, I'm going to say it was named after a bird. It was my school was named after a particular
ostrich bird. Comprehensive. There we go.
Yes, it was ostrich comprehensive. But the actual heraldry when I was there was the local town shield. So it was a generic shield with a cross in the center and then four more crosses. And it was quite a cool, like, relatively respectable-looking crest, even though the school uniform itself was pretty dang basic. But I was allowed to have a bit more flexibility. But again, I think there was a lot of, like, trying to make it work for poorer people when I was going to my school. What about you, Chris? Did you have a cool school crest?
We had a school memorial achievement, but I can't remember what it is because I... And our town has one too. I did consider getting my family's shield tattooed, but then I'm glad I didn't because it would have made me look like a white supremacist because, like, it's just kind of...
I probably looked at our family shields, like, a decade ago between you, me, and a couple of other people.
Yeah, we did, yeah, yeah.
We've known each other that long, which is nutty. But, yeah, I can remember us looking... I think I had a pretty cool one, but I can't remember what mine one looked like now.
It has some stags on it or something. I don't know.
I'll put mine in the chat. I just like googled it.
Do you have a website for it that I could check mine on?
It's called, the one that's usually quite good is House of Names. They do like, what do you call it? Lots of...
this is going to be great for the podcasters or the people listening to the audio for this. They're going to be like, we can't see the crest and we're not going to say it. Well, you'll say a name out loud.
Yeah, well, no, we'll be doxing ourselves with our family shields. Yeah. Like,
I mean, yeah, no offense, you've got a slightly more generic surname than I do. No one that I know has... In fact, I can't remember if I mentioned this. I did find one person in a TV show that has my surname.
Okay.
There is someone who is killed.
Don't say the TV show.
it's a murder victim in a quirky murder show where they come up with lots of quirky, original-sounding surnames. There was someone who is named after my family.
Which is strange, because not to give it away, but your name doesn't, like, sound... like it would be such a unique name. Like, it's not like Kludge. Like, you know, like, I can't think of anyone that would have the surname Kludge. Like, that would be like a weird name. But your name sounds very normal for its rarity.
How do you spell that?
Kludge. C-L-U-D-G-E. Kludge.
I've just put the shield that I found on House of Arms.
Hang on a minute. There's not a Kludge shield, is there? No.
Not as far as I know.
No, see, very rare name. Very rare name. Kludge. What about the Plunge? Plunge. No Plunge family shield. I mean, some of these are there will be like different, like some families are easier to look up than others, because if you like a Smith, then like, I mean.
There's like 100 Smith families.
Smith family shields,
If anyone's listening to this without the visuals, my family shield is a. Suit of armor wrapped in gold and silver leaves, and it has three stags on it, and a chevron. There we go. And Chris's is a green and silver with six crosses, and it almost looks like, are they staffs?
Crooks. Are they shepherd's crooks?
Ah, they're crooks. Ah, cool. You're saying it's a traditional Welsh name.
No, Ware is actually Devonshire, English.
Hey, we're from the same neck of the woods.
Yeah, so...
I'm told that mine comes literally from Dartmoor.
Dartmoor?
That's where it is. Dartmoor, yeah.
Oh, cool. That's very
At
English.
Least that's what my cousin said at their wedding, yeah. From the narrow moorlands of the Darts.
My name comes from the, I think it's like a village or a hamlet or something called Ware, W-E-A-R-E, which is the original spelling, and then over time the A got dropped. So there is a village, I've been to it, where it's called the village of Ware. There's Upper Ware and Lower Ware, I think. And the priory is where my family started. There was a man and a woman, and they got married, and they got gifted this bit of land, they got gifted a priory to look after. They were like the stewards of this priory, and the priory is called Ware, and that's where their surname then came from. And the priory, like, I think since then, like, they've moved away or things have happened, and now it's just like a village hall where they do like yoga classes and play groups and stuff, but it still exists.
Nice.
So, yeah.
All I know about the Johnstons is that they were probably originally from Scotland and then stayed in Northern Ireland for a little while before moving to...
What are the three little America? Things that look like biscuits or dominoes on your one, Max? They look like little pastries. Three little pastries. And again, this people who are just listening on the audio.
are they little whirlwinds?
I don't know what it. I don't even
cornet,
know.
Cornet crisps.
The crisps. Blah blah blah.
Is it a drilling apparatus?
It looks like a pillow or something. I don't know. It doesn't say. It literally doesn't say on this on House of Names, unless I'm missing it completely. A spur. Wait, a spur. And is it a spur? Spur.
Yep. According to spur. According to House of Names, my surname originates in Cornwall.
I think, I don't know if it's House of Names, but one of those kind of sites where they put your family shield on a mug, they do source the, you know, where it comes from. Because I ended up looking at my sources, the two sources that were like commonly cited, and I actually bought the sources. And I say, when I say bought the sources, most of the sources, because they're like medieval sources, they're like freely available on like archive.org and stuff. Like it's all public domain at this stage. But I actually ended up getting them printed in a couple of hardback books. I think I've shown them at some point.
Part of me really wants to like take my crest, even though it's relatively boring, and do like a Game of Thrones costume, but integrate my crest into it, like the Game of Thrones costumes do, like when Sansa does all of her costume embroidery with like Stark direwolves or with like the leaves of the tree. Like, I don't know whether or not there's a way of me integrating it. It'll be a relatively boring costume just because colors aren't that exciting. I mean, I could do something. It's quite Baratheon.
It is quite Baratheon. I quite like the look of it. I don't know if... Is the crest, the bit on the top, is it four feathers? Or is that just like the generic crest that they give to people who don't have a crest?
I think it must just be the generic crest that they use for this particular website.
Yeah, yeah. Because like...
Getting that idea.
How they you can present it any way you want. Like so on House of Names, they've got the mantling, which is like the fabric around it of the two like family colors, which is usually a metal. So white or yellow is usually like to represent two types of metal, and then a fabric color, which is like, so that's red, blue, green, black. I think that's the lot. I can't remember. Obviously not purple, because either purple's saved for royalty or it wasn't invented yet. I think. I don't know.
It was hot. I mean, in the same way that we were talking about Beesbury being a relatively easy iconography in order to use in multiple contexts, I can see purple, if it was so expensive to produce, being not something you would necessarily choose for your family arms. Because that sounds really expensive to be able to replicate onto your various household goods and other such things that might require branding of some kind or heraldry of some kind.
Although, on the other hand, it might be a display of wealth. You know, like how old lords used to have the idea of the lawn was originally because landowners were like, I'm so wealthy, I don't need to use my land to grow crops. I'm just going to put a lawn on it and play see rich people games. You know, like it was like that overt display of opulence and wealth. So maybe purple, but also like I think in House Dane, do they have purple for a shield?
I think House Dane, the whole thing with them was it's like they're an ancient line of ancient heroes with tragic stories and all of those sort of things, which
but in
you know, then George R. was like, well, that time's gone, get over it.
But in Game of Thrones, I'm guessing purple dye is like not as it's not as royal and it's not as prestigious as
I think red would be more the red and black are the royal colors, I guess.
See, red and black,
Targaryens.
Yeah, because red and black aren't two colors that go together in British heraldry, because you got because neither of those two is a metal. And in my head, and I don't know if this was ever done on purpose or if George R. R. Martin's ever thought about this, but black to me could potentially be in the Game of Thrones world dragonglass, which it obviously isn't a metal, but it is like it takes the place of metal in heraldry. So black and so in, but this can maybe only, not necessarily only apply to Targaryens, but like would apply more to Targaryens that have that dragon lore about them. And obviously Dragonstone, where you mine dragon glass, where Aegon's seat was before he conquered Westeros. Like, it, you know, it makes a lot of sense to choose dragon glass as like your metal color. And then, I don't know, like, red as your fabric color. But that's like the only sort of circumstance where I can kind of see it making sense, where it wouldn't here, if you get my meaning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that being an interesting. Well, obviously, we have the greens, the blacks of House of the Dragon, mm-hmm. So that I've never really viewed the black color. I always, obviously, the green comes from the Hightower, and my brain, mm-hmm. the black comes from just Targaryen. I never really associated the black with dragonglass, but or Valyrian steel. But if that was the reason why they chose black, then that's a really interesting like way of weaving it back into the world.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is why I love Game of Thrones.
We might be giving
more stuff.
We might be giving George R. R. Martin a little. Maybe he did on purpose, and I'd love to ask that question at a Comic-Con if I ever. But like. That's how I rationalize it in my head, how the black comes in. It could be complete bullshit. It could just be he picked those two colors because they fitted the mood of the Targaryens, the sort of like a sinisterism.
Like jealous, like if you the amount of, like, in the same way that the Princess's Promise can be read into a thousand ways, the color green and the color black. You can choose how you view that. Like, you could say it's green because of the Hightowers, which is because of cleanness and because of dragon fire being a the dragon fire being green flame, so it's like false dragons because they're not using real fire, they're using false fire. It could be the color of envy, it could like the cover, like for the blacks it could be the cover of grieving or mourning or the color of sadness or depression or dragon glass, or like you and metaphors can go on forever, and I love going into the metaphors, but there's also a point where you're also like, I need to nap at some point. it can go on forever. And I suppose again, the ultimate kind of answer that George R. R. tends to pitch is it doesn't matter the symbology, it matters what the characters do, and relying on symbology is an effective way to live life. And that's again a really cool to put that much effort into building a world so full of iconic imagery, of metaphor, of symbology, of prophecy, and then to also be like, well, fuck that noise, it's just kind of dumb and fun, and I love it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the only shows where I instinctively just throw myself in that deeply, pointlessly.
I mean, it's not pointlessly, because it's fun.
Funfully. With gay abandon. Right,
indeed.
I've just checked the time. It's well past my bedtime. So should we...
I'll let you guys...
Have you got any more notes there, Jenny? Yeah.
No, I finished my notes a while ago.
Awesome.
Any more notes about the Amish? Any more questions about the Amish?
I might prepare some for the next podcast.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Okay, cool. All right. Thanks for joining me, folks. Thanks for everyone at home. And until next time, toodaloo.
Toodaloo.